We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey gang, this is Chad. A confluence of events has occurred, including a snowstorm here, that caused me some difficulty in getting an episode out this week. No Reds news to talk about anyway, so I apologize for not having a new episode, but I really think you're going to enjoy what we do have for you here. This episode is we're going to call the Riverfront Classics series, right? This is episode number 58 of the show. And what this is from October 6th of 2010. October 6th, 2010. So if you're thinking ahead of me here, you might think, oh, okay. Yeah, it's a preview of the playoffs that year that Chris Garber joined me for. And you'll tell we've come a long way since 2010, this show has. Goodness, we're talking over 11 years now. It's hard to believe. But Chris and I kind of break down all the matchups, made our predictions, and we're pretty excited about that, you know, the Reds' first playoff appearance in a million years or something, and sort of unexpected. So sit back, relax, enjoy this. I really do think you'll enjoy it, and keep giving us that feedback. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode for you here at the Riverfront. Thank you all. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Red Leg Nation Radio Podcast, a pretty special edition today. We're talking about the playoffs, and we're talking about the Cincinnati Reds in the same podcast, somewhat surprising. I'm your host, Chad Dotson from RedLegNation.com. Joining me is one of my fellow editors at Red Leg Nation, Chris Garber. How you doing today, Chris?
Doing great, Chad.
Good, good. Glad you could join us today, and it's going to be a fun one. Season's over, and people are still talking about the Reds. You can't say you expected that when the season started.
I did not. I thought maybe, I don't know, we'd be talking about who our next manager would be. Figured maybe Dusty might have been gone the day after the season ended or something like that, but I didn't think we'd be in the news the way we are. So it's been a great surprise, and probably a year earlier than I thought that idealistically maybe we'd be good in 2011, but I'll take it any way I can get it.
Absolutely. You know, in the preseason, Bill Lack and I spoke on one of these podcasts and pretty much agreed that we thought, you know, maybe around 500 team, if things go well, slightly above 500. And then, like you said, that next year would be the year when they take that big step. Well, and certainly they're a year ahead of schedule, and I'm not complaining a bit. It's been a lot of fun. But we drew the Philadelphia Phillies, a two-time defending National League champs, and we'll do some predictions maybe later on. But what are your just sort of initial reactions to having to play the Phillies?
Well, you know, the last week or so of the season, we were trying to sort out who we're going to play every day. And the Phillies are obviously the elephant in the room. They're clearly the best team in the league, maybe the best team in baseball. So, you know, first thought is you don't want to play them. But you got to play them eventually. If you want to make it to the World Series, you want to win the ring, you got to beat the good teams anyway. And the more I think about it, I think the Reds actually match up pretty well against the Phillies. You know, and it's not a trip to the West Coast, which it could have been for San Francisco or the Padres if they'd made it. And like I said, the series where the Reds got swept right around the All-Star break in Philadelphia was a rough series, but it was really good baseball. I think the Reds played really well, and so did the Phillies. And hopefully we'll see more baseball like that here in the upcoming week.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right that the Reds do match up fairly well with Philadelphia, and of course,
you know, you don't want to go too far with that because it's clear the Phillies are the best team around, and like you said, possibly the best team in baseball. You know, they won more games than anyone in the National League, and they're a solid team top to bottom. But you start breaking it down and taking a look at it, they really have an edge over the Reds in starting pitching. And we'll get into some of that a little bit more in just a moment. But really, overall, it's not a bad matchup. And my thoughts have been this. If we're going to play the Phillies eventually, I mean, I guess if we didn't draw them in the first round, there's a chance they'd lose and we wouldn't have to play them in the National League Championship Series. But if you got to play the Phillies, wouldn't you want to play them in a best-of-five series? Don't you think maybe the shorter series might maybe a little more of a crapshoot or may help the Reds, give the Reds a little bit of an edge?
I think that's a great point. I mean, if you're David, you only want to play Goliath as few times as you have to. So, yeah, I mean, it's anything can happen in baseball and anything can happen in a short series especially. So I think you're right. That's a great point.
Yeah, the cream could maybe rise in that seven-game series, and who knows? Maybe that gives them a little bit of—I wouldn't say an edge, but something for us to hang our hat on as we're looking to to make a case for how the Reds are going to win this series.
So, I want to talk about anything other than Roy Halladay, Roy Oswalt, and Cole Hamels. I don't want to talk about that part of the game at all. So,
short series
matchups, who hits better fly ball pitchers, all that kind of stuff—I'm cool with, but. Let's not talk about their big three.
Well, I'm sorry, but we're going to talk about that later. But I agree.
Talk about Kyle Kendrick?
Yeah, let's talk about Kyle Kendrick. Exactly. Their number two starter a couple years ago, I think, in the playoffs. Well, let's talk about the playoff roster. I think, you know, Mark Sheldon posted something not long ago here, and it's not been announced yet. The playoff roster won't be announced, I bet, until 9:59 tomorrow morning because they're due at 10 a.m. the day of the game. And that's sort of the way Dusty's been operating lately, just not letting anybody have any more information than they're entitled to. But I think we'll see it tomorrow morning. And Mark Sheldon makes the case, and we'll dig into some of the names in just a moment. But he says that final spot comes down to Jim Edmonds and Juan Francisco. What are your initial thoughts about that?
Well, you know, I think that's probably right. I think that for some reason they like to have a lot of left-handed bats around, and Edmonds is obviously the guy they wanted. They got him at the point of having him on the postseason roster. They got him to be a bat off the bench and maybe even a spot starter against well, this is when Jay Bruce wasn't hitting so well, so I think that idea is done. But, you know, maybe they put Edmonds in left field if he could play it. But I think so. If he's healthy, he's the guy to put on the roster. If not, I guess Francisco is useful. I'm not positive that I would be comfortable putting Francisco in a game, honestly, in a playoff situation, in a close game where, you know, there's just better options all the way through than Juan Francisco. I can't imagine him getting into a game, but I suppose it's either him or, well, I don't know who, another pitcher, I guess.
Yeah, Corky Miller, maybe. Possibly, and who knows, Corky's mustache could bring a little bit of the mojo we need, but... You're right. My feelings about Juan Francisco are well known. I'm not comfortable at all with him, certainly not in a spot where you need him to put the bat on the ball to give you a chance to win in the postseason. But there's really not a whole lot of since Lance Nix is healthy and probably going to be on the roster, looks like. You know, the rest of the roster sort of shapes up the way you would expect. The only thing is the bullpen is who they would bring in the bullpen since they're going to go with three starting pitchers and Homer Bailey and Travis Wood out to the pen. And I think probably the most logical thing is obviously you're going to have Cordero and Arthur Rhodes and Nick Massett. Logan Ondrusik, I think, and Bill Bray are the last two guys. There's some other guy, Chapman, yeah. I think they'll probably have Aroldis Chapman on the roster. But
yeah, I think he might have a role against the Phillies.
Maybe.
I'm actually a little bit surprised about Bray. I mean, I'm trying to see, you know, what he's done for us lately, I guess. And I'm just looking here, and he pitched pretty well the last couple months of the season, I guess. But, you know, I guess I would have maybe thought Jordan Smith would stick around for that roster. Do they need, you know, I guess they just think they want to load up with lefties so they don't have to, you know, let a left-handed reliever face any of the right-handers in the Phillies lineup. I guess that's the idea, so they can just mix and match. But I don't know if they really need with Rhodes and Wood and Chapman out there. I don't know that they really need to flip flop guys back and forth. Those guys can get out lefties and righties just as well.
Yeah, I think if you're making a choice between Bill Bray and Jordan Smith or whoever you're making that choice between, I don't know that when you're talking about the fourth left-hander in the bullpen, I can't see why it would be that big a deal. If you've got three, when you consider that there's going to be so many off days during this series, you're going to be able to use that bullpen however you need to use the bullpen. You know, guys are going to be getting their rest, and you can use some of these guys more often than you would maybe ordinarily. So I don't know that having Bray out there just because he's a left-hander is the right idea. But on the other hand, he's been okay lately, and I can't say that Jordan Smith necessarily gives us a better chance or in that spot.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, if either one of those guys is pitching, it's probably not it's probably not the greatest situation, I'm guessing. And I'm happy with the Lehman Mary guy on the roster.
There you go.
Since we're talking about bullpens, I read a really interesting article about by Dave Cameron on FanGraphs today. I don't know if you saw it.
Great article,
Yeah, he proposed something really interesting that I'm sure Dusty Baker's not going to do in a million years. But he basically said, throw Volquez out there and tell him you're going to go a couple times through the order and knock yourself out. And then if he's worn out in the fourth or fifth inning, then you just roll out either Wood or Bailey, get those guys to go three and bridge yourself to your relievers, the back of the bullpen guys. And it's a great idea. I mean, given the structure of this series with the one day on, one day off, there's only, I think, two back-to-back games in the entire series. So you don't have to worry about rest, really, for anybody. Bullpen, regular position player, you don't have to worry about anybody's rest. You can unload the bullpen every day if you want. I don't think there's a chance in the world that Dusty's going to manage like that. It's just he's not an out-of-the-box thinker when it comes to in-game management. But it was a really cool idea, and if you encourage anybody to go over to fangraphs.com and check out that article.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's sort of what I was thinking about that article when I mentioned earlier about the way to use the bullpen in terms of having those days off. I think it's a great idea. You send Volquez out there and just tell him, yeah, rock and roll. You know, you're going to bat once, maybe. You know, do what you can. If 75 pitches is all we can get out of you, you're going full strength, and you know that's fine. We've got plenty of pitchers behind you to back you up, and it's an interesting way. Gets into the bullpen a little earlier, and it allows Dusty to play some of those matchups a little bit earlier in any key spots in terms of the lefty righty splits. And I thought it was a fascinating article as well. We probably should link that from Red Leg Nation. I'll try to remember to do that when I post up the podcast because it's really I agree. It was a fascinating idea, and there's no chance we'll see it, but it's an interesting way to think about it.
Yeah, I mean, when you've got eight relievers, I mean, that's the kind of thing you should think about doing. I mean, you can do it, and you probably should, especially when you got all those off days. It's probably not intentional, but that's a lot about how Sparky Anderson managed his bullpen back in the Big Red Machine days, in the postseason especially. You'd just see starters coming out of the game when they'd get two guys on and one run in, and that'd be that for them. But I think the Reds, Dusty lives and dies a little bit with his players, and that's how it's going to be. So hopefully we'll get the Edison Volquez in game one that we've seen, that the Louisville Bats fans saw and then the Reds fans saw in September, where he was probably one of the top four or five pitchers in baseball the last month in the big leagues. And then, in addition, the three starts he had down at Louisville, he tore it up there. So hopefully he's got it figured out.
Well, let's hope. It was a surprising pick to start game one. But, on the other hand, like you said, he's pitched awfully well, small sample size, I suppose. But there have been spots here lately where he's looked just incredible. And I've been saying since the first time I watched the guy pitch after he came to Cincinnati in the Josh Hamilton trade that his stuff is just about as electric as anyone I've seen when he's on. The problem is whether or not he's going to be able to hit the strike zone, and that's a continuing problem. Although it's not been as bad maybe lately as it was at one point when he first came back from this Tommy John surgery. But, he's pitching well. He is probably the most talented of the Reds pitchers. And, the more I've thought about it, the more I've come to, I don't know if agree is the right word, but to understand where Dusty Baker's coming from and making him the game one starter. And, I can't really argue with it too much, I don't guess.
No, it's a little bit I'm talking about Dusty's a conventional guy, but it's a little bit out of the box thinking, really. I mean, the expected move and the veteran, if you're a manager who loves veterans and all that kind of stuff, as Dusty has a reputation, the move is to put Bronson out there and let him do his thing. And either good Bronson or bad Bronson shows up, he's not going to throw a no-hitter, but he's you know, arguably most of the time will keep you in the game. On the bad days, you're going to be blown out by the second inning. And, you know, but nobody's going to question putting Arroyo out there in game one. So, you know, my hat's off to Dusty on this one. I think this is a creative thinking. And, you know, if Volquez is way off and he walks six guys in two innings, you know, Halliday's probably, you're not going to beat him anyway. So, you know, you got good matchups then in the other two games. So,
yeah,
I can see it.
Yeah, Dusty, thinking out of the box. I like the sound of that. You know, another thing there is, we all thought Arroyo would because he's a veteran and because he's had some postseason experience. But when you look at the Reds are going to be facing Roy Halladay, they're probably not going to get a lot of runs, as you said. So maybe Volquez is the guy that, if he's on, gives the Reds the best chance of really shutting down the Phillies lineup. At least this is what I'm thinking that Dusty may be going through Dusty's head, rather than Arroyo, who, you know, keeping you in the game is not going to cut it. Although Arroyo always keeps us in the game usually, that's not going to cut it maybe against Roy Halladay. You need somebody that can possibly
pick exactly. You've got to have a Travis Wood, you know, not quite a perfect game through eight, but you got to have a top-notch ace outing to beat Halladay at his own game. So I think Volquez is probably the most capable of the three of you know, throwing a no-hitter.
And, you know, I've been dreading facing Roy Halladay anyway, and you just reminded me. Travis Wood almost had a perfect game. They still couldn't beat Halladay. So yeah, it's going to be a fun game one, I guess.
I've just got in front of me here, Chad, some of the versus Halladay versus Reds hitters, and I don't know if you've looked at it, but for a guy as good as he is, you know, the Reds players have hit him okay. I mean, I think they probably do better than the league average is against him. I mean, it's mostly a sample size thing, and you know, Votto's 3-for-11 with a double and a homer, so that helps. But other than Orlando Cabrera, the other guys are all in the 750 to 780 OPS range. I mean, they hold their own. I mean, Jay Bruce is also 3-for-11 against them. I mean, these are tiny sample sizes, but at least, you know, they're not 0-for-11 with 10 strikeouts.
Right. They're not going to, they shouldn't be afraid to walk up to the plate, I guess. You know, and we talked about that game where we almost had the perfect game and Halladay won. But, you know, the start before that against the Reds on June 30th, the Reds got 13 hits and 4 runs off Halladay. So, I mean, this is not an impossible task here. We don't want to make Halliday's a great, great pitcher and as good a pitcher as you're going to see anywhere, but he's not invincible, and there's reason to believe the Reds could do okay against him.
Yep, one thing I hope to see out of the Reds, I hope they play the same kind of fundamentally sound quality defense, sharp baseball that they played for 150 of the games this year, and not the cue the Benny Hill music games they played against the Cardinals there, where Johnny Gomes is throwing the ball over Hernandez and he throws it back over Cabrera and then it goes through somebody's legs and you know, I don't want to see that, but if they play the sharp baseball they normally play, they can play well in close games, I think.
And even if they don't play that sharp, at least we've gotten a Benny Hill reference out of it. So, you know.
Right. So feel free to cue up that music on the closing credits.
There you go. Looking at over the potential, yeah, I agree with you about that before we move on. I think that if the Reds play some of that baseball that we've seen from this year, the good defense and the, you know, smart base running, and there have been times this year where they've been nothing short of outstanding there, you know, still game one against Halladay, and things are all of a sudden looking pretty good for the good guys. And so I would hope they'll come out sharp and ready to play focused. Just looking briefly at the rest of Mark Sheldon's proposed roster, and I think is absolutely the way it's going to be, but again, who knows with Dusty, but Ramon Hernandez and Ryan Hannigan, catcher, infielders, Votto, Phillips, Cabrera, Roland, Cairo, Yanish. I mean, it's the same guys, outfielders, Bruce Stubbs, Gomes, Heisey, Nix. There's really no surprises out of any of these. Really, it was just that last bullpen spot with Bray or Smith or whomever, and then the final spot with Edmonds or Francisco. So, not a whole lot of surprises. There are no Billy Bates being added to the roster at the last moment here, so we sort of know what we're going to get. Any surprises that you see out of there? Or is that pretty much what you expected?
No. And, you know, I'd have been real surprised if I'd seen Chris Villick on there or something like that. I mean, you could make a case for just about anybody. Everybody that's put on a red uniform this year, just about has played pretty well while they've had it on. I think we looked at that a few weeks ago. That, you know, all the bit players have outperformed their projections and they've all contributed. So, you can make a case for a lot of different guys being on that roster, but I think this is the makes a lot of sense. It's hard to argue with anything that at least what Sheldon projects Dusty's going to do.
Oh, I hate having a situation where it's difficult to argue with something Dusty does. I'm not used to that.
Yeah, I know. Every you know what though, everything's sunny right now.
So. It is,
they can throw $4 million a year at him and sign him up through 2012, and I'm not going to complain this week.
I know if you'd told us that 12 months ago, I can't imagine the meltdown that we'd have had at Red Leg Nation. But today, you know, nobody wants to say anything at all because, hey, you know, he's for all his faults, and there are some, he's taken this team to the playoffs, and I'm so happy about that that I just I can't I'm trying really hard not to look at anything that's
you know, and the thing about it, I mean, like I said, it's maybe I'm just blind right now, but we get. You know, the stuff Dusty doesn't do well, it's pretty obvious. The in-game stuff can be crazy. The lineup stuff is crazy. And the stuff he does well, we only hear about. We never can see it ourselves, and we only hear these rumors. And it's the same kind of rumors you hear about, you know, Derek Jeter's defense. Oh, you can't see it with your eyes. But, you know, Dusty's management of people is legitimate, I think. And you look at so many other teams and so many other managers who get no results at all. You know, they're bad in-game, and they're must not be good at motivation either. So, you know, if Dusty's a glass halfway full, I'll take the half full, I guess, and rather than keep looking at what's not there.
Yeah, and I've also, with Dusty, tried to, at times, and I've been trying to do this lately as well, take a little bit of a step back. A couple of examples. Back in the mid-90s, I used to complain to some of my friends and people that didn't really follow the Reds as closely as I did about Jim Bowden. At the time, though, the Reds were kind of winning, you know, and he had some high-profile successes with the guys he picked up. And day-to-day, you know, I was irritated just about everything the guy did, but these other guys were like, what are you talking about? You know, the Reds are competitive every year, and, you know, he did this right.
Pete Shurik.
Right. Exactly. He picked up Pete Shurik, and it worked out. And so I at that time, I tried to sort of take a step back and see, well, what are they seeing that I'm not seeing? Because I'm too close to the situation. And our friend of the podcast, Joe Posnanski, writes occasionally about Gardenhire, Minnesota's manager, and about how he just thinks he's the best manager anywhere because look at the success he's had. But the guys that follow the Twins every day will say, well, they're in this game and that game, and you know, tactically. And we all complain about the things Dusty does day to day and the silly lineups and things like that. But there's, as you said, there's something to his managing of men, and he's doing something right. The players love him and love playing for him. And, you know, I just wonder if maybe we need to take a little bit of a step back. And although most of those criticisms are legitimate that we've levied against him, maybe we're not seeing the forest for the trees in some instances. I don't know. I just trying to justify thinking both ways on it, I guess.
Yeah, I'm with you.
All right, well, let's transition quickly here, unless you have something else to add on anything we've talked about so far.
No, it's
we've been talking at Red Leg Nation about we've been doing some previews and sort of doing a head-to-head comparison of the Reds lineups and the rotations in side-by-side with the Phillies. And, of course, Phillies blog's been doing the same thing. We've been sort of going back and forth a little bit. And I thought it'd be a good way to sort of look at this this matchup and see how the Reds stack up. You know, everybody expects the Reds to be huge underdogs, and when you start looking at it a little closer, maybe not, as we mentioned earlier. We'll start with catcher, obviously. The Reds, Ramon Hernandez and Ryan Hannigan, no complaints about them this year. There are small complaints. Hernandez is weak defensively at times, and, you know, there are issues with his arm and things like that, but both guys have, you know, put up OPS pluses. Hannigan at 127, Hernandez 114. I mean, you can't argue with that. Philadelphia's primary catcher, of course, is Carlos Ruiz, who had a pretty fine OPS himself, right in line with what Hannigan did. And you see any advantage either way at catcher? I don't.
I don't see much. I mean, Ruiz has smoked the ball in the postseason the last few years, and yeah, whether that's something that can carry over from year to year, I probably don't think so. But I love the Reds catchers. Hernandez can infuriate you sometimes, but you know, the guy's pretty consistent at hitting. I mean, he gets his hits pretty regularly. He's not a real streaky guy like some of the other hitters we have, which is nice. And Hannigan, I just love. I mean, the guy calls a good game. the guy catches or receives the ball well. He throws well. And, you know, that's one thing. It's not really a comparison, but, Hannigan, I think his caught-stealing numbers kind of suffer, and I think that's as much to do with who he catches as with his arm. I think he gets guys that allow a few more base runners and don't hold them as well, I think. And so I think that's maybe a function of situation rather than him, because I think he's got a great arm. So I think this was a pretty close call between the two teams.
Yeah, definitely. And I agree with what you say about the Reds catchers. Hannigan is just love that guy. I mean, he does everything well, seems like. And, you know, Hernandez was a guy that his reputation had lagged pretty badly at the end of his time in Baltimore. People saying he was lazy, and he's certainly not Hannigan's equal defensively. But, you know, from literally day one this year, Hernandez has hit the ball. Like you mentioned, the consistency, he's been, you know, steady all season long. I keep waiting for him to fall off, and he never really has, and I've been very, very pleased with what we've gotten out of him. So you want to take first base?
Well, first base is – thanks, because that's a really easy one.
It is, isn't it?
You know, I don't know if Charlie Manuel thinks it's easy, but it's Joey Votto's a lot better player than Ryan Howard is defensively as well as offensively. I don't know I think this is – I'm really excited about this series, and I hopefully – the Yankees will be done in three games so we can actually get a primetime game so somebody in the country can see Joey Votto play and see how good he is. I mean, it's just that's one of the things. You step back and you look at those numbers and you're like, wow, this is a 1024 OPS in a, you know, a deflated ball a little bit era. And I just hope he comes through big in the playoffs, doesn't put too much pressure on himself, and really puts up some big numbers. And I hope Ryan Howard strikes out three times a game.
But he'll still...
I like Ryan Howard, but I just really want him to do poorly this series.
He'll still be Charlie Manuel's guy. I like Ryan Howard, too. I thought that he's got this huge new contract that was way more than what he's worth. But, yeah, I like watching the guy play. And he's not a bad player. And I don't, you know, we talk about how Votto's clearly a better player, and it reminds me of, you know, don't compare anybody to Johnny Bench, you know. Don't embarrass anybody by comparing him to Johnny Bench, like Sparky said, and not calling Votto Joey Johnny Bench, but don't embarrass Ryan Howard by comparing him to Joey Votto at this point. Ryan Howard's a nice little player. He shouldn't have made the All-Star team over Votto. He's not Votto's equal in any respect, but. I'm with you. Nothing against him, but it wouldn't hurt my feelings to see him striking out. And I just love to see Aroldis Chapman make him look silly once or twice.
Like somebody said today, I don't think he wants to see that at bat at all.
No.
I don't think Howard is looking forward to that at all.
No, I can imagine anyone is, but certainly not Howard. Moving on to second base, and this is, you know, I think there's a pretty clear edge at second base, but it's a sort of an interesting interesting matchup anyway. Obviously, Brandon Phillips is the Reds' second baseman, and, you know, he made the All-Star team this year, and everyone thinks he's a pretty good bet to win the second Gold Glove. We'll see. He leads on the ESPN Baseball Tonight web gems, if that means anything. And he's had some highs and some really low lows, and at the end of the year his hitting stats were pretty good, above average stats, and, of course, good fielding. But on the other side, you've got Chase Utley, who, you know, he's among in the conversation, certainly, for the best second baseman in the National League, if not right on top of that. I give Philadelphia the edge there, and I think that it's not extremely close. But, you know, which Brandon Phillips are we going to get, I guess? If we get the one that's been awful at the plate the last month, we're in trouble. If we get the guy that, you know, played earlier this season, maybe it's a little bit closer than it would be otherwise.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, Phillips' numbers at the end of the year are pretty close to what they were the last couple years. I mean, once you adjust it for the offensive level of the league, he actually had a better year. But, you know, the hand injury obviously bothered him a lot more than we probably thought. I mean, or some people thought anyway. I mean, he was not right after he got hit in the hand, and he seemed to hit a little bit better the last two series he was. He was 7 for 20 or 7 for 16, so he was hitting the ball pretty good against the Astros and the Brewers there. But man, he needs to hit because he's going to be at the top of the lineup again, and Orlando Cabrera is behind him, and I know he's not going to hit. So Phillips has got to go, or Joey Votto is going to be batting with two outs and nobody on quite a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a it's a situation where we need him. He's going to be leading off, and I was actually going to look up here to see what his on-base percentage was. He had ended up with a career-high on-base percentage this year, slightly, for him. But it dropped. It was at 343 when he got hit on the hand.
It cost him 10 points, 11 points then by the end of the year.
Yeah, so in the last month it dropped some. I actually wouldn't have been surprised to see that it dropped more. His OPS, actually, where it hurt him was in his power. His slugging dropped from 458 down to 430. So his OPS went from 801 down to 762 in that month. Although, you look at the last few games, and it really was, I guess, the last week, 8 days, something like that. He started hitting better and with more power. And so, we're trying to be optimistic, and you're hopeful that he's going to come back. If he doesn't, it puts the Reds really behind the eight ball. So I'll let you take third base if you like. Do you agree, though, we give Philadelphia the pretty clear advantage at second base?
Yeah, it is. It was interesting reading on Crash Burn Alley how confident they are that Utley is, quote, clearly the best all-around second baseman in baseball. I mean, I think he is, but they really rely on ultimate zone rating over there, at least, that Bill does in that particular article. And I'm not that convinced with defensive metrics I'm definitely not convinced that Utley's the defensive second baseman than Brandon Phillips. I don't think that's true. So
no, I don't either.
I don't watch him. I watch him 10 times a year. So
I'll say this, though, whether he's the best defensive second baseman or not, and I've come to like Phillips this year more than ever before, but I can't imagine there are very many people that wouldn't love to have Chase Utley on their team. I mean, he's just
that guy's legit. I mean, and that helped that he got hurt there in the first Red series and wasn't available for him the second time around. I think that made a pretty big difference. I think they played some of their scrubs more than they planned to this year. So, but third base. So Scott Rolen came back to earth a little bit in the second half. I mean, he was drinking from the fountain of youth there in the first half, and came back to earth and he nicked up a little bit the back. But on the whole, obviously, I'm thrilled with what he's done. I saw him in spring training, and I thought he looked like Frankenstein. I mean, he just couldn't move his upper body at all. I thought it was going to be a long, long year for him, and he came out of the gate strong and played great. So, obviously the question is who we're going to see in this short series. Is Rolen, is he feeling good? I don't know. He doesn't talk. Does the extra days of rest help him, or does the cold weather hurt him? You don't really know. On the other side, you got Placido Polanco, who is old and beat up himself, and on the season, he really didn't do much at all offensively. And he's an okay third baseman, but not a great one. So I think the edge is Rolen's. But I can see Rolen not doing a whole lot in the series, unfortunately. He needs to, but I could see a series where he, doesn't produce a lot, or I could see a series where he takes over and is the MVP if they had one.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's clear edge for Cincinnati, but at some point during this season, Rolen has looked just awful. The last month and a half, there's been times when he just couldn't do anything right. Overall, really a fabulous season. Before the All-Star break, I never in a million years would have guessed that Rolen could put up that type those types of numbers for 3 months. And even if you look at his overall numbers in the second half, actually, they're pretty much in line with what I thought we'd get out of him. And they're not bad,
you're right.
They're not what he put up in the first half, and maybe he spoiled everyone, but even his probably normal level is not bad and still better than what you're going to get from Polanco. But if somehow he could, for a couple of weeks, recapture some of that the power and some of the magic from his first half, he was fun to watch. Not a whole lot to argue about there. Polanco, is Polanco. Polanco has actually played in the league longer than I thought he would. I wasn't impressed with him ever, and he keeps hanging around. And, he gets to start for good teams all the time, so I don't know. But
Well, you get to talk about my favorite Red, I think.
You know, I miscalculated. I meant to set this up so that you would get a chance to talk about. I'm going to talk about my favorite red here, I think, and we're going to leave you to do left field next. I think that's your favorite red.
No. I was referring to shortstop.
I know, and I'm going to do that. But I think that
you're stuck with number seven. All right.
Yeah, I think that that you might have more fun doing that one.
I may go off on a Dennis Miller rant here.
That's fine. I don't want to get off on a rant here, but at shortstop, you know, and you made a comment to sort of saying kind of what I was saying as well. You know, I looked and looked and looked for some way to praise Orlando Cabrera, or to find a silver lining, or to find something where Cabrera has been a quality player for the team this year. I came up with a lot of nebulous stuff, things like we say, everybody says about Dusty Baker, I guess. Everybody likes Cabrera. Matter of fact, I've come to like him over the year. He seems like a really good guy. He in the clubhouse, people like him, and it's clear he's a leader on the team. And it was funny when he was a bat boy in that one game, and you know,
I think that all I can say for Cabrera is he didn't try to come back from injury quickly, and he let Paul Yonish play.
Thank you very much.
I tried today. I looked, and I was trying to say, well, maybe Cabrera will get hot. Maybe he's got a week in him where he can, you know, he'll hit 400 and he'll slug 500 and he'll kind of carry the team for a week. I mean, every player in the major leagues has a week like that. So I started looking through it, just trying to find any 10-game period where Cabrera was hot. And I found, I think, one 10-day period where he had an OPS over about 850. You know, he just does what he does, which is he hits about 265 with just a little bit of doubles power. You know, he had that 650 OPS almost every one of those 10.
Yeah.
He didn't have a lot of, you know, just total zeros, but he had almost every one of those 10-day periods was at 650 OPS. Consistent, just consistently bad.
Yeah, and you could maybe hide somebody like that in the lineup if, A, he's a brilliant defensive player, or, B, he's batting eighth in the lineup. But, of course, and that's really where it's hard to fault Cabrera for this, but that's where it's killed me, is just having to watch him up near the top of the lineup and at the top of the lineup for much of the year. You know, and when you look at his hitting numbers for shortstops, he is right at the bottom. I mean, he's in the bottom two or three in just about any statistic you want to look at, any of the advanced metrics or even the, you know, old stats that were the rate stats and everything that we're used to for years. Defensively, you know, he doesn't make a lot of errors. You know, I mean, he handles the ball well. He just doesn't get to very much.
He's got good hands. He gets rid of the ball pretty quick. He turns the double play okay. He just doesn't have any range.
Yeah, it's what happens to 36-year-old shortstops.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's not his fault. But he's actually been a little bit better defensively than I expected him to be this year, just in the sense that if he can get to the ball, he's making the plays. He just doesn't get to as many of them. So, you know, I want to be able to say something nice about Cabrera. It's tough, you know. I'm a fan of Yonish because even though if Paul Yonish is probably not going to hit much, although he hit okay this year, better than probably anybody expected for him, and certainly he hit very well when Cabrera was out, at least you're going to get some elite defense out of him, and so that's why I've become a Yonish fan. Just he's just fun to watch in comparison, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know what you can say for Cabrera? You can say that Jimmy Rollins batted 243 this year, and he batted 250 last year. And you know the guy's got an MVP trophy on his shelf, but you know, he had a rough year. He had a rough year last year, so I know he's banged up. But it's hard to really give them a strong edge here.
Yeah, I think they've got the edge, but I agree with you. You know, Rollins has been in a pattern of decline the last 2 or 3 years, and it's nobody really saw it coming. And those are a couple of guys that maybe if you talk to just sort of the Joe fan, you know, they would think, oh, Jimmy Rollins, you know, he was MVP, you know, he's great. And same with Cabrera, really, you know. One of my friends who's a big fan of the Twins sent me a sort of a tongue-in-cheek email after the Reds clinched and said, congratulations on Orlando Cabrera leading another team to the playoffs, you know.
Well, the funny thing, Rollins is the kind of guy that, you know, if this was 15 years ago or 20 years ago when we were growing up, he would have been in the All-Star starting lineup every year.
Yeah.
You know, he would have been one of those guys who, even after they quit playing well, would have just had the name and just would have been, you would have kept punching the ballots for him. And I think All-Star voters are a little bit, you know, more savvy now and pay a little more attention to the numbers. But Rollins still has, you know, the star persona, and I guess he could still turn it on, but, it's kind of a, you know, lesser two evils thing here with him right now.
Yeah, at some point you got to wonder if Rollins is just not done. So I think, like I said, I think Philadelphia has the advantage here, but not as big an advantage as you would expect given you know, who the Reds have are running out there. And that's sort of a similar situation, I would say, in left field. And I'm gonna, I know you're itching to get started yeah. on this. I'm gonna step aside and give you the floor.
Well, I'm interested in who can come up with the better Johnny Gomes missing the cutoff man joke. I know we've, I think we're trying.
Oh yeah,
and I'm gonna keep trying until he hits one, but or I die.
But, whichever comes first, right? Yeah,
basically, in left field, you've got two guys who are supposed power hitters who aren't hitting for power, who can't play a lick of defense. I guess, you know, it's nice that Johnny Gomes doesn't make $10, $15 million a year, but it doesn't do us a whole lot of good in this series. So, you know, Gomes carried the club in May, I think. He did a lot towards carrying the club in May, but outside of that month, I mean, he's just about a dead average player. And that's not, that doesn't do it in left field, and it really doesn't do it in left field when you can't run or field. So, you know, it's possible, unlike Cabrera, Gomes can get hot and can carry the team. I mean, he can start just drilling the ball, but I don't know if Gomes is particularly known for squaring up really good pitchers. And I think he tends to hit mistakes a lot. He can hit a fastball, that's for sure. But in certain spots, and he will swing at bad pitches and, you know, get himself out. Johnny has some really quick at-bats before you even see him stepping in the batter's box to do his little show. You blink, and he's walking back to the dugout with his mohawk. So I don't know what the silver lining is. I'm trying to look at his numbers against the Phillies. I mean, I guess, you know, he's got a home run off Cole Hamels and one off Halliday, and we got two off Joe Blanton if we happen to see him. But
I hope we see Joe Blanton.
yeah, I think good things are happening with Joe Blanton, right?
That's right. Well,
you know, and go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, Ibañez has just had a really woeful year. Ibañez had the year that everybody expected him to have, you know,
yeah.
last year. Just to come back to earth.
Yeah, absolutely. And everybody that he surprised last year, you're right. He's sort of come back to the player everybody expected. Gomes, you know, I thought you weren't going to mention it there, which is clearly Gomes's best. I don't know his biggest advantage here. You did finally toss it in there at the end. Is that mohawk? I mean, you know, you got to give him some credit. I mean, you know,
he's a mohawk. And he stomps around and he flexes his muscles and he does all the stuff. I mean, I would not be surprised if a lot of kids love Johnny Gomes. I mean, he's a demonstrative guy. I mean, he, you know, he hustles. I don't want to take it away from him. He plays hard. He's like Ryan Friel with a different skill set. I mean, it's 110% effort, not always for the good, but you can't question the guy's desire or his effort. So, you know, he's just not a – I don't know. I'd have Chris Heisey out there 7 days a week, especially in the postseason when you got to catch the ball a little bit. But as I think I wrote over on the Phillies blog today, you know, Gomes is a double waiting to happen on any pitch, and I'm not referring to when he's at bat.
Yeah, I know. And at mid-June, you know, his numbers were great, and everyone was loving Gomes, and I never could have expected it. Well, I guess I could have expected it, but would never have hoped that it would have gotten this bad by this point. His numbers are just bad. He's been better than his hitting numbers are better than only Carlos Lee and Melky Cabrera this year, and defense is
the two biggest disasters in the National League. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, there's not many ways to sugarcoat it, but now when it comes to sugarcoating, I'm going to tell you, Tom Brenneman told me Gomes has a .333 batting average with two outs and runners in scoring position this year. So he's clutch.
And without any supporting evidence or examples, Tom will tell you that he's playing a really good left field too. So,
I have heard him say that, but that's
I just need to have Tom over to the house while I watch these games.
Right. Maybe part of the, you know, and a lot of people have been actually complimentary, not just Tom Brenneman, but complimentary of Gums. And maybe a lot of that is because, you know, it seems like in a lot of big situations, he has sort of gotten a hit, you know, and that's why he's batting 333 in those situations. But it's just it's a situation where Philadelphia has a pretty poor left fielder of their own in Raul Ibanez. And I don't see any way that we can't say that he's better than what the Reds have. So you got to give the advantage to Philadelphia.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think that's true. So, but you know, the good thing is Ibanez plays lousy defense. Ibanez has no arm. So, you know, the Reds have this season done a really good job. And I don't know if it's Billy Hatcher's credit or Chris Spires or whoever does the advanced scouting. They will run on people that they can run on. I mean, they ran on Matt Holliday incessantly the first half of the year, especially. I mean, if they, you know, they hit one in the corner, they're definitely going to two. If they hit a single to the gap, they're going to try to stretch it. So hopefully they'll try to take advantage of Ibanez that way.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think that it's something they've done all year, and I'm looking forward to watching them do some more of that in this series. We'll move on. The next couple of positions are a little bit more interesting from our perspective. Center field, you know, and I want you to point out some of the things you were pointing out in a comment I thought was really interesting when you looked at what Stubbs has done lately. But Drew Stubbs says, for a guy that's in his first year, first full year playing in the major leagues, you know, had some, again, some highs and some very low lows. But when you look at it, he's really had a pretty good year. And I stuck his numbers next to Shane Victorino, who's obviously the starting center fielder for the Philadelphia Phillies. And their numbers are remarkably similar. They're not, you wouldn't put them side by side and think that they would put up similar numbers because they don't look anything like each other. You know, Stubbs with a 108 OPS plus, you know, great defense. He's hit 22 home runs. You know, I don't have any complaints about Drew Stubbs, and you can make a pretty good argument that I called it a push on the website, but you can make a good argument that Stubbs is better right now.
Yeah, I think right now he absolutely is better, and you know the numbers that you're referring to. See if I can pull them up here. I just looked at what Drew Stubbs had done after what was it August 1st?
I think so. After August 1st, yeah.
It was mind-boggling. I mean, his OPS would have ranked fifth in the National League. I mean, it was something like 943 or something crazy like that. Since August 1st, 308 with the 393 on base and a 550 slugging. And he's stolen 12 bases. If you put that out to 162 games, it's 70 extra base hits, including 30 homers and 39 steals. I mean, it's basically, you know, you put that in center field with that kind of defense, that's an MVP right there. And I didn't know it. I had not noticed that in the last, whatever it's been, 9 weeks. I did not know he was doing that. I know he'd had a couple of good games, and he seemed to hit home runs a little more often than he had been. I had no idea that he was smoking them all that well.
Yes, exceptional production, certainly for a center fielder who plays great defense and getting better defensively every day. You know, Bill Lack and some other guys that watched him down in Dayton and in the minor leagues have been raving about Stubbs' defense for years now, and he had maybe some hiccups early in the year, but he's great defensively, and man, if he can hit like that, that's a guy that I'll take every single day. So no complaints about Drew Stubbs this time. And it's funny, he kind of hit that streak when they were talking about sending him to the minors. If you'll recall, Chris Dickerson was going to come back, and all of a sudden, Stubbs started hitting.
Exactly. I think that was right when he was slumping. So Dickerson was traded for Edmonds. Edmonds promptly got hurt. And then everybody got hurt. So that there, you know, not only could Stubbs not get sent down, Stubbs couldn't even get a couple innings off because it was going to be Miguel Cairo out there. So, you know, he was dusty, had no real choice but to play him every day. And that must have been what was going on. We were, you know, throwing our arms up about the Cardinals series and then about there only being three outfielders on the roster. And then, you know, Brandon Phillips' hands hurt and when's Drew Stubbs coming? I mean, Jay Bruce coming back. And I wasn't paying attention. Drew Stubbs is just killing the ball.
Yeah, he took advantage of the fact that they were sort of relying on him more. And a lot of people love Drew Stubbs right now for good reason. You want to move over to right field, and I'll let you take this. And that's, I think, the most interesting comparison. Maybe not the best comparison for the Reds' advantage, but interesting one.
Yeah, it is an interesting. And that, you know, one thing about these position by position, I mean, it's a logical way to do it, it's fun to do, but you know, not every position is created equal, and not every, you know, slight edge is the same as a slight edge here or there. And and you know, whatever. Catcher's not as important as first base, I
Absolutely.
Guess, from an offensive standpoint. So, but anyway, I mean, Jay Bruce has, I think, arrived. I think we were all, in varying degrees. I mean, I think you and I have always been huge fans of his, but I think a lot of fans were impatient and wanted, oh, we need to see some development. And then others of us were saying, hey, he's 23 and he's been playing in the big leagues for 2 years. I mean, it's whatever you're getting is pretty good. But I think, you know, with the injury he's had, what he's done in the last, you know, close of the season has been phenomenal. And I'm looking at what he did in that August 1st to the end of the season. 338, 418, and he slugged 699. That's an 1118 OPS. I mean, that's up there with Joey Votto. And that's on pace for 57 home runs in a season. So, so Jay's been hitting the wall well. Hopefully he rolls that right in. I mean, obviously the moment when they clinched was a great moment and one that'll go down as one of the most memorable Reds moments the last, 15 years easily. So, on the other side, you got Jason Wirth, who is a really athletic player. I mean, that's how I always think of Jason Wirth, as a really just an exceptional athlete. He's not nearly the defender Jay Bruce is. He's got a good arm. He's fast, but I don't think he plays. He's not as good a baseball player in the field as Jay is. But he had a great year, too. He's really the only Philly hitter who had a great year this year. And Wirth, I think he kind of carried the team. He had 46 doubles and 27 homers. You know, he walked 82 times. I mean, the guy's legit. I don't know what his weakness is. I haven't really found one. So, you know, I guess the good news is he's right-handed, and the Reds got three right-handed starters. I'd probably call this thing a push, but maybe that's I think a Philly fan would give them the edge. So,
that's
what I'd say.
That's about the way I did call it a push at Relignation, but. Based on some of the things you were saying, but you know, Wirth is an outstanding player, and he is he's like you said, he's the one guy who really has been exceptional for them this year. About Bruce briefly, one thing that has been heartening, I guess, in terms of Bruce's development, and when you say Jay Bruce has arrived, one of the reasons why it really is starting to appear like he has legitimately arrived is he has started hammering left-handed pitchers lately like never before. He'd been talking about early in the season, and there were times early in the season when he looked better against lefties, but he'd been talking about what he did in terms of wanting to be like Joey Votto and approach him the way Joey Votto approaches left-handed pitchers. And he's really done outstanding, you know. 11 of his 25 homers were against left-handed pitchers this year, and, of course, the memorable one on the night the Reds clinched. And let's be clear about the night the Reds clinched. It was one of the most probably the most amazing moment I've ever been part of at a ballpark. And I tried to get you to go to the game. So
that's why I'm downplaying, because you drove 6 hours and I wouldn't drive two.
Well,
I'm a little bitter about it.
Yeah, it was a magical night. But I'm the same way. I feel the same way as you do about that. It's a I'm very comfortable. Although they've got a great right fielder, I'm very comfortable with the guy that we've got out there in right field as well. Especially when you take into account his. Outstanding defense like I've never seen a Cincinnati right fielder play. I just you know, and I think you put it just he's athletic and he goes hard after balls out there, and you never would think that a right fielder would be fun to watch play defense. It's certainly not like we talk about with the shortstop, but he is. He's fun to watch out there.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that he redefines the position, but he plays it differently than anybody. I mean, I think Ichiro is probably the best right fielder I've ever seen. Maybe probably the best, besides maybe Barry Bonds, the best defensive outfielder I've ever seen. But Jay does a lot of fun things out there, and I really respect how hard he plays. And you know, he's a first round pick. He's a super talented guy. He was buddies with Dunn and Griffey, who had kind of a bad reputation in some circles. But I don't think Jay Bruce gets nearly enough credit for how hard he plays the game. I mean, that guy gets after it. He hustles to every single, every double. He gets in good position to throw, and he puts a good throw on the bag at second every time. So I'd like to see him get a little more respect. But, you know, I could see him making a play in this series, kind of like the Paul O'Neill play in game two of the 1990 LCS, where he threw out Van Slyke at third, or like a Dave Parker play from the All-Star game in 79, where he makes a play defensively that kind of, puts his reputation to match his abilities and defensively.
Yeah, and it's a good opportunity on a bigger stage for him to do something like that. And the thing I keep saying, I do want to agree, I think nobody would have been surprised if he were sort of I don't know what the way to put it is, but the typical first-rounder, hey, look at me. Instead, he does. He plays as hard as anyone on the team, but it's fun to watch. The thing that I keep thinking about when I look at Jay Bruce and the numbers he's put up and what he's doing now, the guy is 23 years old. It blows my mind.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, if he was a college player, he would probably be finishing up. He would have finished the season in Double A, getting ready to go to the Arizona Fall League.
Yeah. So, that pick panned out. Okay. We went a little longer on that than I wanted to go. And let's quickly, if you don't mind, let's shift over to the starting pitching matchups. And you're absolutely right that, the way we did this, some of the matchups with the position players is it's mostly for fun. It doesn't have a whole lot of, it doesn't mean a whole lot other than just sort of a fun way to compare the teams. But now the pitching matchup's a little bit different in terms of these are the guys that are going to be pitching the same games against each other. And we've already talked about the game one matchup at length, Roy Halladay versus Edinson Volquez. Anything else you have to add to that? I think we've maybe...
No.
Yeah, it's going to be tough for the Reds, certainly because Halladay's good, but Volquez is... I love Volquez, so we'll see what happens. Hopefully, it'll be the good Volquez. Game two is a very interesting matchup in a million different ways. Roy Oswalt going for Philadelphia. Obviously, Oswalt for years with Houston was just a Reds killer, a Glavin-esque Reds killer. Was 23. He's currently for his career 23-3 with a 2.81 ERA. But this year, before he went to Philadelphia, the Reds finally started touching him up and beat him up pretty good in a couple starts. And the Reds are countering with Bronson Arroyo, who my favorite player, frankly, just because he's fun to watch pitch. What are the storylines, I guess, from an Oswalt Arroyo matchup?
Well, I think Oswalt have the Reds finally figured him out. I mean, I think we all know the history, Roy Oswalt dominating Cincinnati Reds. He was the 2000s version of Tom Glavine, just a complete Reds killer. And then the last four times with the Astros, the last two times in 2009 and the two times we faced him this year, the Reds have gotten to him pretty good. And I think his ERA is 6.5 or a little bit more than that. So, Oswalt's gone back to his old form since he put on a Philly uniform. I don't know what that means. I think Arroyo, I think we kind of talked about him a little bit. He can keep you in the game or he can melt down. But I don't know what we're going to see out of Oswalt. If he's on like he used to be, it could be trouble. But, the guys he used to dominate aren't here anymore. He won games against Sean Casey and Adam Dunn and Ken Griffey and Austin Kearns and Barry Larkin and Eddie Taubensee, for that matter. So I think that they've shown an ability to square up Roy Oswalt a little bit in the last couple of years, and hopefully they've got at least some confidence in that game.
Yeah, I think that I'm more concerned about whether Arroyo is going to toss a stinker out there than I am what the Reds are going to do against Oswalt. Maybe that's unjustified given the way Oswalt's been pitching since he came to Philadelphia, but I'm comfortable with that matchup. Cole Hamels versus Johnny Cueto in Game 3. I thought Cueto would be going Game 2. I don't know if this played into what Dusty's thinking was, but Cueto's been a little bit better at home this year than on the road, and surprisingly, considering the type of pitcher Cueto is, Cole Hamels, wasn't that good last year, and this year he's been pretty good again. Left-hander.
He kills the Reds, man. He just kills them.
Yeah.
What's his ERA? 1.07 against the Reds in his career? I mean, it's something insane.
Yeah, 6-0 with a 1.07 ERA in 7 starts.
I don't know how we ever get a no decision against him. I don't that guy just kills the Reds, but I don't know. I don't think Dusty was thinking home field with Cueto. I think it was just a matter of putting the junk baller in between the two harder throwing guys. But it is remarkable how well Cueto's pitched in Great American Ballpark. I don't know of any other pitcher that has that kind of split that pitches better there than on the pitcher's barks.
Definitely. I went back to look at Cueto's numbers against Philadelphia, and it's hard to look at the career numbers against Philadelphia because he had that game last year where he gave up about 98 runs or something.
Yeah.
But this year he's pitched against him twice, 1-0, 1.2 ERA, went 8 innings in one of those games, gave up a run on 6 hits, and then got a no decision after pitching 7 strong innings, just giving up 4 hits and 1 run. So he's had some success this year against Philadelphia, so reason for hope there as well. Any other thoughts about the pitching, about anything with respect to this before we make our predictions? Anything else about this matchup that jumps out at you that we haven't mentioned?
No, not really. I mean, we've talked about the Reds bullpen. I mean, we could talk about the Phillies bullpen a little bit. I'm not all that familiar with them, honestly. I know, you know, they got Brad Lidge, and hopefully he can go back to his old melting down ways. And Ryan Madsen's been awesome for him. I think they want to put the ball in his hands, and you know, they'll probably use their bullpen less than the Reds use theirs. The Phillies starters are probably going to go deeper in the games. At least that's, I'm sure, their plan is they run those guys 7 innings, let Madsen have one, and then, you know, J.C. Romero pitches against Jay Bruce and Joey Votto and hope for the best with Lidge. And he's had a good year. So, you know, I think that's probably about it. Spend too much time talking about guys who aren't going to pitch unless it's a mop-up.
Right, yeah. Unless you want to spend a little bit more time talking about Bill Bray, because I think we beat that one to death earlier.
Yeah, in retrospect, maybe that we may have lost some listeners during that part.
That's right. Hopefully they came back. All right, then. Well, I guess, you know, at this point, nothing left to do but make some predictions. I just put a poll up at Red League Nation earlier today. You know, what do you predict for this series? And it's going about the way I expected the votes would go at a Reds-centric site. But you have a prediction for us?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not going to predict the Reds lose. So I'm going to say the Reds in 5. Can go either way. You know, I posted a clip of that Eric Davis home run from the 90 World Series, and I think – this team's pretty resilient. I mean, I think this team could lose the game 1 on the road to Halladay and come back and still win that series, the Reds. But it sure would be nice to have Joey Votto, you know, smoke a laser in the first inning over that right field wall and get the Reds off early and you know, give Volquez a lead to come out to pitch. So something like that happens, I think I'm going to feel a lot more relaxed.
Yeah, definitely. And that was my prediction I made the other day, and haven't actually written it on the website yet, but Reds in 5. Obviously not going to pick against the Reds. But you posted that video earlier today of Eric Davis in game 1 of the 1990 World Series off of Dave Stewart, who was as intimidating a pitcher as there was in the league really at that time. I guess non-Clemens division maybe, was an awfully good pitcher, and Davis stepped up with the Reds' big underdogs and just smoked the ball. And they're really, you know, you always think, well, people's made too much of the fact that the Reds thought, hey, we can do it now. But there was really sort of a feeling, hey, you know what? We can play with these guys. And I could absolutely see a similar situation with a team like this year's Reds, who nobody's expecting much of, hasn't expected much of all year. And Joey Votto step up and rip one out to left center field or something, and all of a sudden everybody's like, hey, you know what? We can do this and sort of follow Votto's lead. I can see something like that happening, and maybe that's wishful thinking, but it makes sense with the type of team that we have this year. Like you said the word resilient. They have been all year, and their team is, I hope, ready for prime time at this point.
Yep. I you know, I looked up today. I found that when they had 3 real bad moments this year, the sweep in Philadelphia, the sweep in Denver, and the sweep in Seattle, I thought were 3 really tough stretches for them. Or not, you know, not the Denver one, the Cardinals scores at home. Yeah. And after every one of those, 2 of them they went 8-2 after, and the other one they went 6-4, and then won a few more games after that. So, you know, I don't want them to lose all 4 and then become resilient, but or all 3 and then become resilient. But you know, I think they can do it. It's short series. Anything can happen. The Phillies are a better ball club on whole, but put it this way, it's closer than the 1990 series was on paper.
Yeah, definitely. And I've been tossing that term believe around all year because, well, not for the last couple months, because this team has really sort of made us believe, and I want to believe badly that this team can do it. So it's going to be fun. I can't imagine being more excited. I just can't wait for first pitch to get here. It's fun to have playoff baseball back in Cincinnati.
Yep, it's going to be great.
Definitely. Chris, appreciate you joining us. Appreciate all you guys out there listening to what ended up being a lot longer discussion than I expected, but it was a lot of fun talking about the Reds in the playoffs. Thanks for downloading us. All the previous episodes of Red Leg Nation Radio can be found at the RN Radio tab at the top of Red Leg Nation, and you can subscribe via iTunes. And hang with us at redlegnation.com because we've been having a lot of fun lately talking about this this fun team, and let's hope we got 11 more wins out of this bunch. For Chris Garber, this is Chad Dotson saying so long.